We're about to be joined by first-time guest Ted Decker. This is going to be very interesting, I do believe. First of all, I just, I was looking. We didn't get a chance to talk earlier, but I was looking around here, and I think you're going to find this going places that you do not expect it to go. And we're not going to talk about the balance sheets of the prison system, necessarily. It's not going to be nuts and bolts and boring stuff like that. We're going to get to the philosophy behind the incarceration syndrome when we come back with Ted Decker on Coast to Coast AM. New York Times best-selling author of more than 20 novels with a total of more than 5 million copies sold worldwide, known for thrillers that combine adrenaline-laced plots with incredible confrontations between good and evil. I like it. We're going to talk about his research into America's incarceration industrial complex. I think we were warned about that by Eisenhower. It was military-industrial. What's the difference? Welcome to Coast AM, Mr. Decker. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, John.
Well, I was telling our friends here that you and I didn't have a chance to get on the phone, get to know each other at all. So it's just, like a cold start, just a jump start. Here we go. Push it off, put it in third gear, and drop the clutch. But I was looking around at your stuff. First of all, you look like an action hero. I see you with body armor and an M16 and in a really exciting movie, on your Facebook page. And then I was reading that Born to Missionaries, am I close already? It lived among the headhunter tribes of Indonesia. Is this true?
This is true, yeah. I was, I just think of me as being from Mars.
And it gives you throw a pair of shorts on, no shoes, no shirt, take off into the jungle. That's how I grew up. It was a completely different culture. Reminds me a little bit of Fort Worth, Texas. But the headhunters there were different, though. They wore overalls with nothing on underneath. Never mind. So what led you to this, to your work? Tell us, who are you, and how do you come to write these wonderful novels and then eventually become involved in research regarding this this thing that I've talked about many times, that these crime apparati are not going to be taken apart because there's too much money in it?
Well, I mean, I guess my journey starts where everyone's journey starts, and it's birth. I was born in the jungles of Indonesia and grew up amongst cannibals. They actually, true story, killed and ate my parents' coworkers when I was about 6 years old. And there's actually a book written about that called Lords of the Earth. But these are just, they're normal people. All people are normal people, including, we'll get to this later, prisoners. People that are within the incarceration system, they're just like you and I in so many ways, and we don't understand that. But I grew up as, as a Caucasian amongst natives. I was really one of the very few white people. Because my parents were missionaries, I had a certain status, but I was always an outsider. I learned the tribal language. It was my first language, and I tried to adapt to their, I grew up as a native, essentially. And it was true, no shirt, no shoes, throw on a pair of pants and off you go. They were, of course, mostly naked, and the women wore grass skirts. And in that culture, the men wore makeup, the women didn't. Lots of piercings, very different from Western culture in so many different in different ways. And from a very young age, I always wanted to know, who am I? Do you remember that old book, children's book that was written, Are You My Mother? It's about this little bird.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah, you remember that? Okay, there you go.
Oh, yeah.
I guess we're dating ourselves. But this little bird's going around, he goes up to an elephant, Are You My Mother? He's essentially trying to figure out who his mother is and who he is in this world.
Yep.
And for me, that journey started very, very early. I have a very philosophical mind. And because I grew up, in a very foreign culture and was an outsider in that culture, and then coming back to the United States when I was 18, that was 30 years ago, I was a foreigner in this culture. So I'm what you call a third culture kid. In other words, I don't belong anywhere. I'm an outsider. And it gives me a unique perspective because I'm always looking in. It's kind of like outside the bubble, looking in, peering at culture. It gives me a bit of a, more objective, perhaps a more objective, at least different perspective on what I see, because I'm not, one of the natives in this country, so to speak, meaning I mean, I've become one over many years, but there's still a large part of me that's just one step back and still asking that question after all these years, who am I? So that, I think, prepared me very well to write stories. I write to discover myself. Essentially, my novels are journals that I happen to monetize. I mean,
that's excellent. So you're effectively a singer who writes his own songs. I think that's excellent.
Exactly. I'm an artist. I look at the world about me, and I look at myself and I say, how does this work? What is the meaning of my life? What's my, you know, why do we hate each other? Why do we hurt each other? Why can't I find love? Oh, here I found love. Oh, this is beautiful. Oh, why doesn't it last? I mean, these basic questions that everybody has. I grew up, of course, a Christian. I became an atheist in my 20s. I'm now very spiritual, but I wouldn't attach myself to any specific religion. These are just broad strokes, of who I am. And really none of that is who I am, but.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm sure our listeners do too.
I'm sure they do too. This is what we discover as we go on in this journey called life, that what we once thought we knew, we don't.
It almost seems as though everything new you discover reveals so many more things that you don't know about.
Exactly. That's so true. I mean, ultimately, we're not even these bodies we think we are. I mean, we start learning through quantum theory and quantum mechanics, all kinds of new stuff. And the more you get into, I mean, there's so much we don't know. But what we can do is explore what we do know, because as human beings, we're driven to understand. We have this cognitive function. I mean, we have a higher mind that allows us to ask these kinds of questions. Who am I? What's my purpose? Where am I going? How do I find peace, joy, happiness? The basic questions.
My main question is, where am I?
Where am I? Where am I? Exactly. I mean,
I know what it says on the GPS, but I'm talking about this whole reality. Where am I? Am I in hell?
Yeah.
No, well, I don't think so.
Well, I mean, yeah, we can talk about that, but I think at times you are in hell.
I think so too.
I mean,
that's why it's always a question. Let me ask you this.
Yeah, go ahead.
You go. No, you're too much fun already. Keep going.
No, I'm just saying you were asking me what drove me to write these kinds of stories that I write. I mean, my stories, so I've written over 30 novels, and sold about 8 million copies. Where people that read my novels are people that, one, like a great ride because I write in thrillers that are very intense. But underneath it all, there are these probing philosophical questions, and not just questions, but exploration of human nature and what makes us who we are. And I throw my characters into very, very difficult situations. And then I let them work their way out of those situations. I don't know how the novel is going to end, but in a way, a story is a way to put our feet to the ground. They're actually more real than just basic philosophies, because it tests philosophies within the context of story. If you just say, the world is flat, oh yeah, we'll jump in a boat and sail across the sea and see if it is. Don't take someone's word for it. We can do that vicariously in a story. That's why they're so attractive. That's why so many great teachers and sages over time use things like parables and stories to communicate, because they're very, very powerful ways to do that. I mean, it's one thing to hear someone spout some kind of philosophy about how life is, but it's very different to actually hear a story that examines that particular philosophy or that particular opinion. So that's what I do, and I do it. I have an obsession. Sometimes I wish I didn't, because it's not always pleasant. It's often, I've gone through a lot of suffering in the process, and you don't have to be cut with a knife to suffer. We know this, yeah? I mean, suffering happens inside where everything else happens.
Oh, minute to minute for some people.
Minute to minute for some people, and everyone suffers, and we're all looking for the same thing. We're all looking for love. Everything is a call for love or a giving of love, period. End of story. All of life's drama is simply that. And, of course, that's true in the prison system, too. So I can talk about all kinds of things. I'll let you lead the discussion. But The Sanctuary, which is the novel that just came out recently, explores you know, again, human nature and what it means to suffer and how within the context of suffering we can work our way out of that suffering, in this case within a prison system.
Well, starting back at the beginning of when the wheels started rolling, the murder of these people, did you say they were caretakers or co-workers of your parents?
They were co-workers.
Co-workers.
Co-workers. Yeah.
And you were about six.
I was about 6 years old. We were in the jungles of Indonesia.
Right. Well, I don't want to be like John Lennon asking that. Well, what did it feel like when the bullet penetrated your... No, John, he shouldn't ever have asked that question. Did you understand as a six-year-old what had happened? Did you have any concept that you could be all right with? Or had you just seen so much of the more brutal side of existence in the jungle that it was sort of more easily accepted than might be otherwise?
Yeah, it didn't really affect me at all. I mean, it was, life there was different. It was a lot, you know, American life, we're a very gentle society. We're very protected. There's very little killing, brutality here in the United States. We're a very nonviolent culture. Everyone says we are, and we jump up and down. We're so protected here in the United States that when we see violence, it shocks us. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just reporting. Yeah,
right.
compared to a lot of other cultures, in particular compared to the culture I grew up in, where it was common for people to be hurt. The average infant mortality rate was 50%. So half of all babies born died within the first 6 months.
That's rough. That's a rough statistic.
It's rough, but it was life. It was that was the norm. My parents brought penicillin into the jungle, and of course that changed a lot of things. And medicine was probably one of the greatest contributions to that particular society. But I remember one time when I was a little bit older than that, walking up to a pile of bones that had just been burnt. They cremated bodies there. And I remember I was on the edge of this cliff with about four or five of my friends. I was probably about 12 or 13 years old, and I walked up, and there was a skull sitting there. And of course, the people there—they're animists, and they have deep beliefs about spirits and about evil spirits, and they're terrified of the dead. And I walked over. I remember picking that up. I leaned over, and of course, immediately my native friends. You know, said, no, don't touch. And I was curious as to how they would respond. So I went and, you know, hooked my finger into the eye socket and lifted the skull off the ground. And they scattered. They were terrified. They wouldn't touch me for two or three days because they were sure I was infected by something. And of course, this is a curiosity because I had no fear of this. It was just a pile of bones to me. And they didn't know the person. It was someone who had been killed in war and, in tribal fighting. And they didn't necessarily know who the person was. But they had great fear of death, and yet they lived in it constantly. People were dying. People died all the time. We would look at that society and say, well, it's a very dark culture. No, the darkness is just, darkness is all inside. It finds its way. It expresses itself differently in different cultures. But it really... What I've come to discover is that they, you know, they were cannibals who say, ooh, that's kind of, ooh, they ate. Well, they killed their enemies and ate their enemies as a way to show dominance primarily. But we take our enemies and do things, different things with them. And yeah. we're cannibals as well. We feed on ourselves. It's all the same kind of destructive force. It's just applied differently in different cultures. So I grew up with a very high tolerance for what we would consider darkness, I suppose. And my novels are quite violent, not gratuitous. I try to tone it down as much as I can, you know. But there's plenty of violence in my novels, and it's probably because of that background. It was different.
That's interesting. So you're the natives that you grew up around. You're you're sort of equal to them. I mean, in as much as they are people and you are people, but you still sort of feel different because, well, you are different. And I mean, were your parents like a little bit of a cultural, certainly they must have been a little of a cultural angle, anchor, pardon me, a little cultural anchor for you so that it wasn't that much of a shock to get out of the jungle.
Yeah, that's true, but I never fit anywhere. I never really belonged anywhere because when I was 6 years old, I left home and I went to a boarding school out on the coast. With Indonesians. So I was with the tribal people up until the age of six in deep in the jungle. But there was no school there, and there was no such thing as homeschooling or anything. So they shipped me off, you know, to a boarding school. And so, and there I live in a dormitory, like it's like going to college, you know, with 100 other kids. It's like, you know, being Oliver Twist. It was like an orphan. And so at a very young age, I learned that I had to, you know, basically fend for myself. I had no one to nurture me, no one to care for me. I felt completely abandoned. And, you know, my parents, I love them dearly. They would probably hate hearing that today, but it's simply the truth. It's what happened. So from a very young age, I felt all alone. I had to figure out life on my own. And the dorm parents, the people that oversaw the dormitories, they were simply just trying to make things work, you know. So they were simply about, okay, if you don't toe the line, you're punished. But there was no real nurturing or affection or love there at all, you know. I mean, they were good.
No reward for being good, just punishment for being bad.
Yeah, basically. And the reward might be, and you can be rewarded. Reward is somewhat helpful, but love is very different than reward. I mean, you say, well, if you do well, if you make your bed every day, then you get these points, and at the end of the week, you get candy. Okay, there's a reward, yeah? But that's not the same as love at all. And it's not nurturing. It's not love. Rewards and rewards and punishment are very limited in their effectiveness in dealing with the human heart, because we're primarily not, you know, that only deals with our motivations, but it doesn't really touch or shape, you know, our ability to love others. You know, it's basically a tit for tat kind of system, an eye for an eye. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And, you know, Gandhi said, and it was very well spoken. So you can maybe, living in a society like that, like in a dormitory type society where I lived, you can learn to toe the line and not deviate from the prescribed path, but that doesn't necessarily make you a person who knows how to be a loving person. You're simply someone who knows how to protect themselves and follow the rules. And this is not this is okay for society, but it doesn't necessarily make you a good person.
Understood. Understood. Yeah, we have an expression now. It's been going around for some time that I'm not feeling the love, you know, I'm not feeling any love here. It's at least, as we're discussing, the candy at the end of a successful day of not breaking any rules. So the reward is, your reward is you will not be beaten or punished tonight because you didn't break any rules. But what would have been worse, I suppose, than the candy that was a hollow reward would be if you behave properly. You'll receive love at the end of the day. Otherwise, you won't. And I think we all know that the most severe torture a parent can impose on a child is the silent treatment where no love is expressed. We'll carry on with Ted Decker into the night, Saturday night. Welcome. John Wells with you. This is Coast to Coast AM. I would submit to you that probably the majority of the persons who are incarcerated in our prisons are for not the hardcore of the hardcore crimes. And as time goes on, it seems like more and more crimes, or at least something that can result in incarceration, just are added to the list more and more every day. And I want to get into that and ever so much more with Ted Decker. I just have to tell you this. This is a little off topic. In fact, it's completely off topic. But Someone just sent a mail that said, I think my smart power meter is turning off my TV. Got a 13-inch TV next to the computer. It's an old-fashioned analog, so it's got a digital to analog signal converter attached to it. And starting about 2 days ago, the digital converter device started turning itself off a couple of times a day, and all he had to do was turn it back on. But earlier, he went and the TV, he looked at the TV screen just before the converter turned off and saw a box with a message printed out and on the TV screen, and it said, automatically going to sleep mode according to the energy policy. With the same letters capitalized as it's posted here. Okay, whose energy policy, he wants to know. As you may have already heard, many new household appliances are being sold with government-required electronic circuitry already installed. So the government can tell the power companies to send signals through the power lines to your smart power meter, and it'll communicate with your refrigerator, water heater, pool, filter pump, TV, and so forth, and turn them off during periods of overly high electricity use. See why it's so necessary to prepare. The listeners who called that were near the stricken area from Sandy. Tropical storm, never made it to hurricane status Sandy, but there's a lot of stuff going on out there. And it would if you wait until the dark clouds are there on the horizon, you're too late to prepare. Now you're just going to have to ride it out and see what happens. So think about that, and we'll be right back with Ted Decker. The Sanctuary is his latest book. His website is Ted Decker, that's DEKKER.com. And a philosophical journey into the mind of a guy who has just become prolific in the number of novels that he's written and the spiritual and philosophical journey that led him to write them. We'll be right back with Ted in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. John B. Wells in with Ted Decker tonight, our first-time guest. It's great to have you on the program, Ted. Now, how did you... show us the pathway, just show us the road or take us down the road that went from writing these novels that I take it they're effectively based in fact. Mm-hmm. How did that lead you to research the incarceration complex?
Well, all my stories are really stories about myself. And one thing I discovered as I grew older is that I'm in prison. I put myself in prison, just like every one of your listeners, everyone out there. In various ways, we lock ourselves up. Now, our prisons are things like insecurities, self-hatred, doubt, and they lock us up. They freeze. Fear is a great prison. Okay, and they lock us up. They turn us into monsters, really, in a way. We do things we don't want to do, and we don't do things that we want to do. So it's like, why can't I break free from these prisons that I put myself in? This is something I just became aware of in my own life. And I said, you know, what a great way to explore, one of the best ways to explore this might be to look at the prison system itself. So... those are the kind of novels I write. So I root everything in reality. And this story is a story about a priest who's put into prison. He's serving a 50-year sentence for the murder of three people. He was a vigilante, a man who just couldn't take the injustice within society. And he would take people aside and give them one chance to change. I'm people that violated child abusers, et cetera. He'd give them one chance to change, and if they didn't change, then he would change them, and he would do it violently, and then dispose of their bodies, or he'd alter them in a way that they could never commit that crime again. Well, through the course of that experience, he discovered that his judgment of others didn't work because he found himself to be just as guilty as they are, just in different ways. And sure. So he turned himself in. He's in prison now. And he's serving a 50-year prison sentence, but he's also taken a vow of nonviolence. Well, within the prison system, surviving, having taken a vow of nonviolence, is virtually impossible, especially he's put into an experimental prison in California where the warden has a very, very strict standard. And his idea of punishment is brutal punishment, depending on what your infraction is. Here's the way, walk you in it. If you deviate from the prescribed path, you're going to pay. And then he pushes the prisoner's buttons. And the story explores whether or not punishment, a punitive system, even works. So I started exploring, researching our prison system, not knowing what I'd find. And I was amazed at what I found. The statistics of our prison system right now are shocking, really. We have, right now, 1 out of every 100 adults will be admitted, will either go to prison for some period of time during the course of the next 12 months, a very high number.
How many? What was it? What was that stat?
One out of 100. 1 out of 100 American adults will be in the justice system over the next 12 months in prison.
Yeah, for anything. Could be back child support. Could be a traffic ticket.
Yeah. The number of people that are in for violent offenses is less than 20%. So actually in the low teens. So most crimes committed in the United States have nothing to do with violence. A lot of it has to do with drug use, possession, or intent to distribute, these kinds of things. Our incarceration rate in the United States has increased 700% in the last 40 years.
700%.
Yeah. I mean, we're becoming a penal colony. In fact, our incarceration rate per capita is 5 times higher than Canada, 5 times higher than any European country. It's one of the highest incarceration rates in the world, you know, and this is not because we have more criminals. Well, we have technically more criminals, but it's not because we have more violent offenders. It's not because we're a more violent country. It's because we have all kinds of laws. We have a very conservative law structure that wants to throw everybody behind bars out of fear. Fear drives our country. So we take people who we think, you know, are drifting from some path. And, you know, prohibition is a great example of incarceration. And prohibition came in the early part of the century, 1920s. It immediately, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were incarcerated over the course of the next few years. And then when it was repealed 3 years later, you know, it went from alcohol's legal to drink to alcohol's illegal to drink. Now, nothing changed about the people about the citizenry. Right. Their hearts didn't change. They didn't become bad people. They were just put into prison because they broke a law, a new law. When the law was repealed a few years later, those who went to prison had to stay in prison. So they had a 10-year sentence for distributing alcohol. They stayed into prison. Well, the problem with staying in prison is prison itself is a very brutal system. It's like taking somebody for a minor infraction, throwing them into a cage with, it's like taking a puppy and throwing them into a cage with bulldogs. Well, that puppy learns how to bite. You have to survive. You have to learn how to get around and to survive in a harsh environment where your cell, you're on a small bunk bed, mistreated often by guards, and restricted in a very severe way. And you have to, a person like that, it's very easy for a person like that to become bitter. So this is why some people call our prisons monster factories. It actually creates, instead of correcting people or helping people or rehabilitating them, it actually takes them and makes them bitter and then throws them back into society, which is why our recidivism rate, which is the people that return to prison now in the United States, is 70%. You know, so we're actually making things worse with our current system. One, we have very strict laws, and two, the people that go in, we're not helping them at all. We're actually making life more difficult for them. And so they come out, and they're more likely to deviate once again from whatever law. Make sense?
Well, it really does. Now, this may be a little simplistic, and you just jump in wherever you want to. In the 1930s, you have economic depression, and you have liquor prohibition. In the 40s, you have serious people. Very serious stuff happening in the world. In the 50s, it becomes, we win, let's build. In the 60s, it becomes, let's be naughty, let's break some rules. In the 70s, let's tart it up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sleaze, little sleaze, horrible, shag carpet, you know, everything. Clogs, bell bottoms, wretched fashion sense. In the 80s, the culture is set, party. Here come the 90s, party's over and nobody wants to stay and clean up. And then for the first 10 years of the new millennium, eviction. Now, is that an oversimplification of the last well, that's, 70 years?
I don't know if it's an oversimplification, but I'll tell you what. Society, you look at society over the last 100 years, and it's no different than our own lives. We try different things. Ultimately, everything that goes up comes down. Everything that goes down comes up. I mean, we live in a world of polarities. And, you know, just like it all boils down to our personal lives. You know, ultimately, we are a people globally that hate ourselves. We never feel like we're good enough. We're trying something new all the time. That never satisfies. So then we turn against ourselves, and we're looking for a new answer. Those new answers never work. And ultimately, throughout all of it, we're just suffering people. And there's only one thing to heal the heart of a suffering person, and that is love. And the problem is, I mean, a great example, I don't know, do you have any children?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so you take a teenager. Let's say a teenager deviates from your path. If you just punish that teenager, i.e., whatever, put them on severe restriction, or let's say you punish them in some way that's more severe than just a simple restriction. If you don't give them love with it, lots of love with it, they're going to just resent you, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
This is what we're doing to our prisoners. We're throwing them behind bars. We're offering them no love. We're expected to heal our society or to keep the streets safe, but it never does, no more than it wins a teenager back. A teenager will just rebel. And, you know, we are a hurting people, all of us inside. We take it out on others, and we punish others hoping that it will somehow save us. But none of it works. None of it works. There's really only one answer to all of it, and that's to take a whole new look at who we are inside. And that is, we're beautiful people. We're beautiful people. But if we can't see that about ourselves, we'll never see it about the other person. We'll never understand how beautiful other people are if we don't understand how beautiful we are. Deep down inside, we are beautiful people, but we hate ourselves because we think we're not good enough. And that therein lies the core problem of all people, whether it's the natives in the jungles of Indonesia or the natives in the streets of America. We are a people of fear, and we hate ourselves. And, you know, this will always end in ruin, and it will, within our own lives and within the life of this country.
I wish you'd stop reading my mind.
Why is that?
Because you just answered the question that I was going to ask you. See, this is why many people, if they had been told in advance, we're going to have somebody we're going to talk about the prison industrial complex. We're going to beat up on those people who are making money about this. It's like, well, there may be a little bit of that at some point, but that's not what's going on right now. What you're talking about is a completely different approach to actually rehabilitating people rather than protecting an investment through what will surely be just a revolving door.
That's true.
I mean, you put somebody in there that has no money to start with. They do some time. Now, not only do they not have any money, but they also have a criminal record to go with it. So what are they going to do except something that's going to put them back in prison?
I mean, you know, is there a conspiracy with the prison system? Not yet. There probably is, and the conspiracy is, it's a social conspiracy, not a few people. Yeah, there's people making money. Of course, there's a huge industry built around prison right now, and they don't want to change the laws because they are making their money, yeah? There's private prisons now. There's all kinds of private industry rising up around prison. But this is a relatively small problem, relatively speaking, okay? I mean, it's a lot of money, but relatively speaking, it's a small problem. That's not what's going to change things. What's going to change things are individual voters and the constituents and the conservative lawmakers. We're trying to protect our streets by locking people away, passing strict laws. Our laws are ridiculously strict in this country, in my opinion. And not only that, but we punish the people who break those laws. It boils down to a whole new look at what changes the hearts of people. People that go to prison are people that have deviated from the prescribed path. Okay, why do they deviate? Well, they're looking for something that works in their lives, right? Let's say they're doing drugs. Why are they doing drugs? Well, they probably enjoy it, but and that's their business. Yeah, I'm not gonna get into that side of the argument. But the reason why someone does something that offends society, let's say it's a true offense, is because they themselves are deeply offended. They are hurt. They are wounded. And so they are looking for love. They're looking for a fix to their lives, just like your teenage son or daughter. They're just looking for love. Well, a loveless society, ultimately, those prisoners are no different than you and I. They just get caught. You know what I'm saying? I mean, and we punish them. That doesn't heal them in any way. It will never work. So, you know, there's no way to fix the prison system. We can try, but it has the fix has to be a change in the hearts of lawmakers and those who vote for lawmakers. And that change needs to be, look, we need to take people that are wounded and that are hurt and that have made mistakes and heal their hearts, not slap their wrists. It doesn't work, but heal their hearts. Well, that means us changing our hearts and learning first of all to love ourselves. You can never love anyone else more than you love yourself, ever. Problem is most of us hate ourselves. Deep down inside, we secretly hate ourselves because we never feel like we're good enough. We can never. Well,
and what causes us to feel this way? Other than a scornful parent of some sort, where you get one of those freaks that they used to make stories out of in using black and white film. It'd just be horrible, and at the end of the deal, the ugly parent or stepmother went away, and the kid was rescued eventually.
Right. I mean, you have obviously abusive cases, but let's just take you and I. I mean, let's just take ordinary people. What causes us to, we grow up feeling not good enough. We grow up feeling we're substandard, like we're not. We never can get really ahead. And as soon as we think like we're getting ahead, something comes along, we don't, and we feel downtrodden again. We suffer again. What causes this intense dissatisfaction with ourselves? I mean, that's a huge question, but it all boils down to what we've been taught. I really think a lot of it comes from religion.
All right. Let's hold it right there. When we come back, we're going to pick it up with how religion may possibly be a factor in making us feel like we'll never be good enough. We'll explore that and ever so much more with our first-time guest, Ted Decker, on Coast to Coast AM.